The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, as it always is. They have been serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now we're going to return one more time to the July 2021 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. Going to read a couple of articles here. We're, of course, going to do our decade reading because this is the last of the month, but we're going to read that article second, and then we'll get on to a third article. But the first one says Inner Peace Center for the Arts in Lumberton. This is part of the I-95 road trip. A beacon of hope. 6 years ago, a U.S. Marine established a safe place in Lumberton for the imagination to flourish. Now, after a challenging 2020, his Visual and Performing Arts Center expands to a historic building in the heart of downtown. Written by Jamila F. Dallas. D-A-L-L-I-S, not A-S. Melvin Morris pauses on the threshold of the main gallery of his new Inner Peace Center for the Arts in downtown Lumberton. The unfinished wood floors are covered in construction dust, but Morris's deep brown eyes radiate clarity. Wearing an untucked dress shirt, jeans, and a palpable air of optimism, he gestures to the expansive, soon-to-be-completed room. Instead of tape and mud-colored drywall, he sees colorful art and a space where jazz musicians perform and poets share their voices. "I'm excited about that," Morris says with a beam that makes it easy to get caught up in his vision. He'd like for visitors to this Robeson County city just south of Fayetteville to give Lumberton a chance, he says, because there's good art and there's good culture here. Morris is no newcomer to Lumberton's art scene. For more than 4 years, he ran Inner Peace out of a smaller building on the east side of town. It was a heady place where adults and children alike met to make and enjoy art and to share their creations with the community. In late 2019, Morris got the opportunity to relocate the facility to a 15,000-square-foot, 122-year-old building at the corner of Chestnut and 3rd Streets in the heart of Lumberton's historic downtown. Then the pandemic hit. Arts programming at Inner Peace stopped. Renovations to the building slowed down, and yet Morris persisted. He worked through 2020 to transform the old structure into a vibrant, community-centered, globally connected nexus for creativity. Soon, rotating murals will cover the building's east and south-facing exterior walls. The first mural, completed in May, offers a glimpse of what patrons can expect to experience at Inner Peace, Morris says. He hopes that the murals will become an Instagrammable destination, a selfie station, he says, for visiting locals and tourists. Inner Peace's new location is remarkable not only because it spans three stories and will be dedicated to both the visual and performing arts in Lumberton, but also because of its history. Erected in the late 1800s, the building has served as a funeral home, an insurance agency, and, beginning in the 1970s, a Kimbrell's furniture store. After Kimbrell's left in 2012, years of neglect followed, and the structure was in need of extensive repairs. Morris was up for the challenge. After all, he thought, the building has character. Remnants of its 40 years as a furniture store include an old freight elevator and picture windows that look out over Chestnut Street. Rich rust-colored bricks hold countless stories from the past, while newly uncovered windows welcome fresh light into the space, the promise of memories yet to be made within centuries-old walls. Walking through the Emerging Arts Center is like witnessing a resurrection, one that's in step with the broader motto of Rediscover Downtown Lumberton, which declares there's no greater community without a great downtown. Morris believes that the arts are key to that sense of community and to help fulfill his vision of promoting works by amateurs and professionals of all ages and backgrounds, especially pieces by Black and Indigenous artists. He collaborates with community organizations like the Robeson County Arts Council and the nearby public library. I feel really strongly about the African-American voice and about the arts that I want to present to the community, Morris says. Art has been a part of Morris's life for as long as he can remember. He was born and raised in Peoria, Illinois. After high school, he joined the United States Marine Corps, where he served for 4 years, the last three at Camp Lejeune in Jacksonville. As a Marine, Morris worked in motor transport and mechanics, and he was also tasked with painting USMC-themed murals, including one of a pit bull erupting out of a brick wall, the image of his platoon's flag. Soon he met his wife, Sonia, with whom he recently celebrated 25 years of marriage. Together they made a home in Lumberton and now have a teenage daughter, Ashley, whom Morris calls his miracle baby, because she weighed only a pound at birth. And then there's Bricks, Morris's mastiff. "That's my boy," he says. Morris spent a few years toiling in factories after leaving the service, but he couldn't deny his true calling, and he eventually found himself working part-time in the mental health sector, using the arts to connect with kids. That job laid the groundwork for the summer camp programs that the Inner Peace Center has become known for. With help from the GI Bill, Morris enrolled at the University of North Carolina in Pembroke, where he studied painting and sculpture. "Melvin is a gem in our community, and his luster is getting brighter all the time," says James Bass, the executive director of UNCP's Givens Performing Arts Center. Bass considers Morris to be one of the leading catalysts of what I believe will be a renaissance for downtown Lumberton. The light-filled second floor of the Inner Peace Center for the Arts is the first fully renovated part of the new facility. And it's huge, roughly 5,000 square feet, housing several spaces, including exhibition galleries. There's also a lounge where visitors can relax, play chess, read books, or take a coffee break while checking out the latest exhibits. As for the large flat-screen TV near the freight elevator, Morris has big plans. He wants to use it to connect with galleries across the country and perhaps at some point the world, allowing patrons a real-time view into other art spaces. As Lumberton continues to safely reopen its public spaces, multipurpose rooms at Inner Peace will host painting and wine nights, jazz bands, birthday parties for children and adults, and other activities. Plans for the third floor include a recording studio and 9 artist workspaces with large windows and open doors that welcome visitors during the town's fourth Friday art walks. Half a block from Inner Peace is the Lumberton Downtown Plaza, the city's meeting place and home to festivals like Arts on Elm and Rumba on the Lumber. There is a stage flanked by a curtain of shade trees, green landscaping, and a fountain. One of the plaza's newest additions is a 9-foot-tall metal sculpture that Morris created on commission from Robeson County and the Rediscover Downtown Lumberton organization. The piece has a bright energy, smiling children, and musical notes surround a burst of sculptural water. It is a beacon for the growth and revitalization that feel as though they're just on the horizon in the city and of in transition. It is a perfect place for the arts, Morris says of the plaza, noting that he can look out the second floor window of Inner Peace and see my sculpture right out here. That's a proud moment for me. A few steps from the plaza is even more art, further evidence of the renaissance that UNCP's James Bass sees coming. a 40-foot-high mural by Scott Nurkin, owner of Chapel Hill's The Mural Shop, stretches 100 feet across the side of the building that faces an open grassy lot. The piece celebrates the natural flora and fauna of Robeson County. A Venus flytrap, lily pads, daylilies, a pine cone, an eastern tiger swallowtail butterfly, and a stork standing in the Lumber River. Around the corner, behind the old Carolina Civic Center, is an alleyway filled with art created by local high school students, some abstract, some figurative, all bursting with color. Morris stands on the corner of Chestnut and Third, taking in the view of his new art center and reflecting on his vision of what the space will become. "I've always felt like the first line of communication was art," he says. "You see it in cave paintings and drawings. Art is the constant communication skill." And that's his vision for Inner Peace, a space where art, in all its forms, remains constant. Inner Peace Arts Center, or rather, Inner Peace Center for the Arts, is at 302 North Chestnut Street in Lumberton, IPCArts.com. You're listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. Questions, comments, 919-781-1973. Now our 1970s Decade of Disruption series, written by Philip Gerard, Lifting Native Voices. A new Commission of Indian Affairs ensures representation for North Carolina's indigenous population. In politics, journalism, the arts, and more, the state's original residents make strides and speak out. For more than 250 years, the Kohari people have lived peacefully along the Little Kohari River in the sandhills of Sampson and Harnett counties. There, they found refuge from intertribal conflicts and the white Europeans who invaded their home in the Neuse River Valley. When the first English settlers landed on Roanoke Island in 1584, the coastal plain was populated by some 30 indigenous tribes, numbering perhaps 35,000 individuals. By 1710, only 5,000 coastal Native Americans remained. The Kohari, descended from the Nusioc, are one of the surviving tribes in homelands across the state, from Hatteras Island to the Great Smoky Mountains. Their name derives from the Tuscarora word for driftwood. The Kohari place great value on their sense of community. Churches serve not just religious purpose, but also as focal points for educational and cultural activities, including ceremonies to honor elders. A yearly powwow begun in 1969 also unites the community while raising money for such programs. Like many other tribes, the Kohari have struggled against a persistent lack of economic opportunity, resulting in stunted educational prospects and substandard housing for too many of their people. Greg Jacobs, who takes on the job of tribal administrator for the first time in 1978, is well acquainted with the struggle. "My mother, who died at 89, had only a seventh grade education," he says. Jacobs, along with the leaders of the Kohari Intratribal Council, worked to change that. In 1971, the General Assembly formally recognizes the Kohari, along with another small southeastern North Carolina tribe, the Waccamaw Siouan, or People of the Falling Star, who live in Columbus, Bladen, and adjoining counties. Recognition makes both tribes eligible for grants and other economic benefits, Jacobs explains. "It made funds available to use in our self-determination to better the health, education, and welfare of our people." And he continues, "State recognition carries another important benefit. For a marginalized people, that may seem invisible to somebody, it gave us a better positive self-image, that we were recognized by the state as a group of indigenous people on land where we had lived forever." Even after being granted such official status, the Kohari don't have political clout. They make up less than 1% of the population of the two counties. Indeed, no single tribe has enough members to be a statewide political force, so leaders from all the tribes have long sought some kind of collective representation. In July 1971, that effort pays off with the creation of the North Carolina State Commission of Indian Affairs. Its mission is to provide aid and protection and to serve as a voice for the North Carolina Native American population. Its 12 Native members, later expanded to 21, each selected by their own communities, take on the charge of ensuring cultural and historic preservation while securing new economic and educational opportunities for all of the tribes. To the larger community, the establishment of such a body might seem like a mere bureaucratic move. But to the tribes, it's a game changer. A big moment is an understatement for what it means to the Kohari community, Jacob says. Before the commission, there was no voice. But even with the commission in place, the Kohari, like their fellow tribes, have to overcome persistent bias and discrimination in their local communities. Jacobs recalls his first meeting with a county manager to explore ways they could work together. Before I even got seated in his office, he said, "Mr. Jacobs, let me be quite frank with you," he said. "We're not in favor of discriminatory groups like yours putting up barriers, and we've just broken down. And I didn't understand his statement, and it hurt. He wasn't interested in hearing my voice. Thus, state regulation and the formation of the commission are the beginning, not the end, of a long road to progress for all indigenous groups in North Carolina. The Lumbee of Robeson County have traveled much the same road as the Kohari. They gained state recognition in 1953, fought off the resurgent Ku Klux Klan in 1958, and are gradually achieving some measure of political power. Several milestones propel their cause forward. In 1972, Pembroke State University, later the University of North Carolina at Pembroke, offers the first courses under the aegis of its newly created Department of American Indian Studies. In late August of that year, Lumbee gained a legal advocate, Horace Locklear, the first Native American to practice law in the state. The chain of historic firsts continues. Henry Ward Oxendine, a 32-year-old law student at North Carolina Central University, becomes the first Native American to join the North Carolina legislature when he is appointed to fill the 21st district seat serving Robeson, Scotland, and Hoke counties upon the death of the popular incumbent Frank S. White. He is also one of five new Lumbee lawyers graduating in the class of 1973, more than doubling the number of practicing attorneys to nine. Lou Barton, also of Lumbee heritage, interviews Oxendine for the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation's American Indian Oral History Program. Barton tells him, "My own father recognized long ago that the thing our people perhaps need most is legal talent." Oxendine replies, "Well, Mr. Barton, while I'm very encouraged about it, I think that this is just the beginning for us. I expect to see the day, and it won't be very long, that in Robeson County we will have Indians in any and all of the professions. More doctors, engineers, dentists, and architects." Oxendine grew up at the Union Chapel community. And after high school, he served for 3 years in the United States Air Force, a tour of duty that took him across the United States and into Canada. Now he returns to Pembroke, where he intends to settle for life. "I think that was in the Air Force that I sort of got some direction for my life," he tells Barton. He remains deeply grateful to his family and to the community who supported him in his studies. "I wish that it was possible to take my diploma and cut it up into various segments of people who have contributed, because there have been literally hundreds," he tells Barton. "I think that it's very good now, in this stage of our development, that Indian people are attempting to help other Indian people. It hasn't always been that way." Though the Lumbee constitute roughly a third of the population of Robeson County, Oxendine is well aware that they cannot afford to wait for the largesse of mainly white commissioners and other local government officials. He says, "Our own elevation is going to have to come from within." And that's already happening. In 1971, Lumbee Bank, later Lumbee Guarantee Bank, is chartered, issuing $667,000 in stock to an investor group that is 97% Native American. It is a true community bank, set up to serve the interests of the Lumbee and their neighbors, an economic engine that can finance business ventures and home mortgages. It eventually expands into a dozen cities and towns. And soon after Lumbee Bank opens its doors, so does a native-owned newspaper, the Carolina Indian Voice, featuring a regular editorial called As I See It by Bruce Barton. Barton boldly wades into political, cultural, and racial affairs in Robeson County. He zeroes in on the county power dynamic. Indians and blacks, generally speaking, are from the same mold, he writes in the bicentennial year of 1976. They hold the political power in their hands, but their bow remains unstrung. Their arrows have no points. They have never used their power. Their potential power has been dissipated by the old game of divide and conquer. Another piece of the Lumbee cultural and political awakening comes with the staging of Strike at the Wind, the ambitious outdoor drama in two acts written by Randolph Umberger, presents the story of Henry Barry Lowry, also called Henry Bear. The outlaw hero of Lumbee waged a guerrilla war against the Confederate Home Guard after they executed his father and brother. Lowry's personal fight continued until he disappeared in 1872, endowing him with an aura of eternal mystery. At the close of the play, the narrator, an elder called the Leader, reflects on the meaning of Lowry's struggle. Upon this ground, Henry Barry Lowry fought for better or worse. His time was a long time coming, but love is the second discovery of fire. And to each of you we stretch forth our hand. May we from this moment on together affirm that there shall never be another time when to ask for the dignity of any man and to strike in vain at the wind. The Commission of Indian Affairs affirms the dignity of 8 North Carolina tribes, which by decade's end includes more than 64,000 members, the largest native population east of the Mississippi. Their time has indeed been too long in coming, but they are no longer invisible, and they are no longer silent. Coming next month in the Decade of the 70s series, Cat's Cradle puts Chapel Hill on the musical map. And now, going back to the front section of the magazine, where we occasionally get to read one or two articles, let's talk about a restaurant in Blowing Rock, a bright spark. In Watauga County, people gather around Bistro Roca's wood-fired oven for cozy comfort and the chef's inventive new American dishes. A wisp of smoke drifts through the dining room at Bistro Roca in Blowing Rock. Oak logs crackle in the wood-fired oven, imbuing local trout and Brussels sprouts with the complex smoky flavors. The wood-fired oven is the heart of a restaurant, says executive chef Seth Parker. When you walk in, you definitely get smacked with the smell of the wood fire. He plunges his hands into yeasty dough as he stretches it into a Neapolitan pie topped with peppadew peppers and Benton's bacon. At 800 degrees, the oven transforms the pizza in an instant, puffing up the crust and creating the charred bubbles the chefs covet. During his 15 years at Bistro Roca, Parker has made countless pizzas and crafted some of the most creative new American dishes in the area. Figs roasted with sour wood honey, drizzled with balsamic reduction and topped with tangy manchego cheese, veal ossobuco over bone marrow risotto, and wood-fired mushrooms. Creative cocktails with ingredients like chili pepper syrup or lavender bitters are served at the restaurant's famed Antlers Bar. A generation back, Parker's parents spent hours lingering over drinks and Antlers, which opened in the early 1930s and is still part of the restaurant today. His parents attended Appalachian State University, and when they weren't studying, they were at Antlers, his father playing music with his band while his mother watched. Today, some of the original bricks and wood paneling are still standing, giving off a rustic warmth that welcomes everyone who passes through. Packer's interest in food was ignited after his family moved to the Outer Banks when he was 6 years old. Family gatherings centered on huge spreads of southern food prepared by his mother and grandmother, who taught him how to cook with care. He started working in restaurants when he was 14, first as a dishwasher. As he worked his way up the ranks, he was mentored by chefs who taught him the classical techniques and mother sauces that are the backbone of fine cuisine. After several years of cooking, I started to realize that I really enjoy it, Parker said. I have a passion for creating dishes, putting flavors together, and just trying to make beautiful-looking food. He initially moved to Blowing Rock for a short-lived relationship, but he found his true love at Bistro Roca, where his wife is the bar manager. The cozy atmosphere has kindled many other romances. Parker officiated the sous chef's wedding as well as the nuptials of two regular customers who got married at the restaurant last year. Bistro Roca is a true local spot where devoted regulars dine multiple times a week. The wood-grained walls of Antler's Bar are covered in framed portraits of customers' pets, a long-standing tradition started by a previous owner. Parker takes great pride in the restaurant's scratch-made staples, including chicken stock that simmers for hours and a rainbow of house-made sauces. He seeks out local vegetables and meats whenever possible, and the pizza dough and most of the bread is made nearby at Stick Boy Bread Company in Boone. I think you should take the extra time and really respect the ingredients you're working with, Parker says. His idea of the perfect dining experience is cooking at home, where he can pass heaping plates of food among friends while they sip wine or scotch late into the night. He wants to create a similar sense of belonging for people who come to Bistro Roca, a vision that becomes reality when customers return week after week to share a meal by the glow of a wood-fired oven. Bistro Roca, 143 Wonderland Trail in Blowing Rock, North Carolina. Brief article now, just to fill up the space. In Mooresville, summer splash. To beat the heat, jump, dive, or swing into this swimming hole at a former rock quarry in Iredell County. Walking the plank is more likely to happen on a pirate ship than a farm, but at the quarry in Carrigan Farms in Mooresville, folks happily waited in line to jump it from the 16-foot-high platform known as the Plank. Their reward? Plunging into 79-degree water for quick relief from the Piedmont's baking summertime temperatures. It pretty much stays that way all summer because it's so deep, co-owner Kelly Carrigan says of the 25-foot-deep, acre-and-a-half swimming hole hidden on the park's 275 acres. While most of the fifth-generation farm is dedicated to growing vegetables and fruit, strawberry and melon fruit cups are staples at the snack bar, the quarry originally provided stone for construction of nearby Interstate 77 in the late 1960s. The discovery of a spring turned it into a natural water park where the scent of sunscreen now permeates the air as guests leap off granite cliffs and drop into the teal blue water. Carrigan Farms, West Entrance, Mooresville, North Carolina, on Oak Ridge Farms Highway. That, my friends, is all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this magazine is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions, comments? Call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.